I'll call to order Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee. The first bill on the agenda is the author, sponsor here, Representative Thiessen, is not here.
We should do 51.
All right. Well, Representative Simon is here, and he's ready to go, so the last shall be first. Representative Simon. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Just one housekeeping matter. There is an amendment, an author's amendment.
Well, why don't you move the bill first?
Yeah, I will move the bill. I move that House File 1117 pass and be moved to the General Register.
All right. Then you have an amendment?
I do.
Would you like to move the amendment?
I move the amendment, Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment. And I could, I'd like to, well, if we could, Mr. Chair, just pass the amendment, and then I'll speak to the bill as amended.
All right. All those in favor of the A1 amendment to House File 1117, oh, wait, we don't have a quorum. We don't have a quorum.
Okay.
Representative Simon, so why don't you describe your amendment, and we'll wait till we have a quorum.
Sure. Well, the amendment is just technical, and it just conforms certain deadlines to the reality of a June primary. That's really all it does. So, very technical, and it makes sure that we're not handcuffing municipalities and school districts who want to do things differently in the odd number of years. That's all it does.
Representative Simon, we have a quorum, so why don't you renew your motion on the A1 amendment? And then all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. All right. Representative Simon, the bill's in the order that you wish.
It is, Mr. Chair.
So why don't you tell us what the bill does?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll have to talk for a few minutes because my testifiers aren't here yet, so bear with me.
All right.
But this is the June primary bill, and I think we have the opportunity today to do something that's helpful to voting and to democracy in Minnesota. I don't want to overestimate the case, but I think it is quite helpful. Right now, Minnesota has the second latest primary in the country, the second latest of any state in the union. And what that means is, until mid-September, in the case of a contested primary, we spend, or candidates spend, I should say, a lot more time talking about who's the best Democrat or who's the best Republican, and not enough time, arguably, discussing who's the best candidate, who's the best office holder, who's the best for all of us. And in a time when people are less and less likely to affiliate openly with a particular party, and they are more and more likely to split their tickets and vote for who they perceive as the best candidate, not based on any party allegiance, I think we arguably have it backwards. And so, as I said, we're the second latest primary in the country, and it doesn't have to be that way. There have been some arguments that this lengthens campaigns and that changing the primary from September to June will make the primary, or rather the entire election season, 3 months longer. I beg to differ with that. I think what happens is it just subdivides the time that we already spend differently so that we have more time talking about who's the best candidate and less time talking about who's the best Democrat or who's the best Republican. And I think we need look no further than what's happening in the presidential election race right now. You know, both parties have a contested race for the presidency. And here we are, so early, already talking about who's going to be the Republican nominee and the Democratic nominee. And I don't think the primary calendar is the driver of that. I think it's other things. So while it may be true that campaigns are getting longer and longer, I just disagree that it's because of when the primary is set. So by moving it to June, we'll do a couple things. First of all, we'll enable candidates to spend more of that time, however long the time is, talking about who's the best candidate rather than who's the best Democrat or Republican. And then the other issue that I've talked with members of the committee about, particularly Representative Broad, is what we do about our folks in the military, particularly those serving overseas. Keep in mind, right now, There's an 8-week window between the primary and the general election. 8 weeks. Now, not only is that bad from the standpoint that I already discussed, which is it only gives 8 weeks for a broke and exhausted victor in a contested primary to make his or her case to the rest of Minnesota, not just his or her party. Not only is it bad for that reason, but it's also bad because as a practical matter, there's a very real risk, and empirically there's the reality, that a lot of those overseas military votes simply do not get counted. And as one person put it to me, who had been involved in several recounts, she said to me, you know, it's interesting that every recount she's been involved with, and this is a conservative Republican, by the way, she said every recount she's been involved with, there are two mounds or two stacks of ballots that are unfortunately left to the side. One is the people who just screwed up the ballot. Second are the military votes who don't get their ballots sent in on time. 8 weeks is a very, very narrow window. And if you talk to any of the election professionals who really make the trains run on time with our election system, they will tell you that by the time in the second week in September you have a certified winner of a primary, then you get the ballots printed, then you get the ballots sent. It's difficult, particularly for overseas military personnel, to get those ballots back in time for election day. And if they're not back in time for election day, they're not counted. So unfortunately, in many of these recount situations, you get ballots of our overseas military personnel, or military personnel in general, but particularly overseas, that are not counted. So I think for a number of reasons, this is a step in the right direction. I would add, and I joked with a number of you before the committee hearing today, I have two handouts. One is an endorsement by the Star Tribune, and then I thought to myself, well, I don't want to attach a lead weight to this thing by among some of my colleagues by talking about the Star Tribune support. So I figured I'd balance it out with the Bemidji Pioneer as well. Those were the two that I could find. I think the point is that this has some widespread support from all points along the political spectrum, and I would add, at the event unveiling this proposal a number of weeks ago, we had, and as you'll see today, I hope they're here by now, maybe not, talk for a couple more minutes, we had the chairs of all three major political parties at the press event, Brian Melendez, who is supposed to be here, Annette Meeks, SD, is over there, and she'll be testifying. We had Ron Carey, the chair of the Republican Party, and we had Jim Moore, the chair of the Independence Party. I think there's a broad agreement here that we need to move our primary earlier. And I will say that there is some disagreement about when the ideal date would be. I know that Representative Broad, and I give her a lot of credit, she's been on this issue for years, and we may have a slight disagreement at about what the very best date would be. I think it's June. I think that seems to be the consensus this year, but Representative Broad has been on record for a number of years saying that she thinks August would be the best. I think we all agree, though, that it ought to be earlier. I'm partial to June, and some of the testifiers will talk about why June and not August or another date. But I think moving it earlier, not only to help our veterans, but again, the bottom line for me, and then I'll get to the testifiers, is, you know, in an era of decreasing partisanship amongst real people, I'm not talking about in this building, but amongst real people out there, decreasing partisanship, which is ironic because we're getting more partisan, arguably, the people we represent are getting less partisan. In an era like that, it makes less and less sense to spend until after Labor Day arguing about who's the best Democrat and who's the best Republican rather than who's the best office holder, who's the best candidate. So with that, and now that I've talked long enough so that the testifiers are here, I'd like a couple of them to come up. And, you know, just in the order that they're on the sheet, why don't we start with that? I'd like to first introduce, and he'll introduce himself, of course, the chair, the current chair of the DFL party, Brian Melendez.
Representative Simon, now that we have most of the members of the committee here, members, we are on item number 6 on the agenda, House File 1117, because Representative Simon and Representative Hilfey were here when we started the meeting, and I flipped a coin and Representative Simon won. So that's why he's up first, and we're going at a we'll swing back up to number one after this bill is completed. So with that, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Melendez, and I'm here in my capacity as chair of the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party.
And do you wish to say anything about this bill? Or
we like it. I am here to say on the record that the DFL party is formally in favor of this bill. Clearly, I don't speak for the other parties, but we all held a joint press conference a few weeks ago where not only the two historical major parties that are represented in the legislature, the Democrats and the Republicans, but also the other major party in the state, the Independence Party, joined in supporting this bill. I join in the remarks that that Representative Simon has already made, and so I won't repeat much of what he said. I do want to respond, though, to an editorial that to an opinion piece that ran in this morning's Star Tribune by Senator John Marty, who opposes the bill. There are two principal arguments that he advances against the bill, and I think neither one of them is supported by facts or by the experience of those of us in the room who are politically active. One of the arguments that he advances is that, you know, people are already tired of the campaign season. The campaign season with this bill is going to be more than doubled in length, and we're going to see more than twice as many television advertisements, which really turn people off. I think there are two assumptions in there that are clearly untrue. One of them is that somehow this bill is going to double the length of the campaign season. Well, that's not the case. The campaign season is going to be the same length under this bill, or it might be 2 weeks longer if we move the precinct caucuses earlier. The question is, how do we allocate the time spent during the campaign season between fighting over, as Representative Simon said, who's the better Republican or who's the better Democrat, as opposed to who's going to be the better public office holder? The campaign is still going to run from late February or early March up through the general election in November. The question is, at what point do we turn from the business of the parties to the business of the people? Right now, we make that transition right after Labor Day with the September primary. This would turn back the clock a little bit. This would move to an earlier date, the time when we start paying attention to the business of the public rather than the business of the parties. I think that's a good thing, but it doesn't affect the length of the campaign season except by maybe a couple of weeks at the margin. The other assumption that that Senator Marty makes in his piece in the Star Tribune this morning is that somehow there's going to be twice as much advertising because the campaign season is twice as long. Well, we all know that this bill is not going to double the amount of money that comes into politics as a result of the campaign season. And the fact that the time between the primary and the general election is twice as long does not mean there's going to be twice as much advertising. There's going to be the same amount of advertising because candidates are going to be able to raise the same amount of money whether that window is 1 month or 2 months or six. What is going to change, though, is that candidates are going to have twice as long to actually connect one-on-one with voters. I think that this bill will change the nature of the discourse and the nature of the campaign as we approach the general election. Sure, there are still going to be advertising. There will still be direct mail pieces. There will still be television spots. But there's going to be time for more debates. There's going to be time for candidates to get out around the state. If in an 8-week campaign period you can make 100 campaign stops, in a season that's twice as long, you can make twice as many campaign stops. And so voters will have that many more opportunities to see their candidates one-on-one right up front and for the candidates to connect directly with the voters. It may be that as a result, there are more public debates. It may be that as a result, the television spots will be more polite and more civil because there will actually be time for the candidates to engage each other rather than having television spots be the only medium with which they can communicate to the voters. I urge you to support this bill. The DFL party is for it. The Republican Party is for it. The Independence Party is for it. And it's a good idea. Thank you.
Mr. Melendez, you started off by saying you're speaking for the people who are politically active, and then you were critiquing Senator Marty's op-ed piece. You weren't implying he was not politically active, were you?
I'm not implying that at all. He's very active. And I didn't say that I was speaking for the people who are politically active. I was pointing out that those of us who are politically active will see the points that I'm making just from their own experience.
Well, to that point, then. So can I take it from your testimony that you are promising us that there will not be, at least on the DFL's part, an increase in television ads, an increase in glossy attack pieces bulging out of our mailboxes, that we will have no more of what we have had in the past? Is that a commitment you're making from the DFL party?
I promise we won't do any more of it than we can afford.
I was afraid, because that's my third question. You said that you can only spend so much, so this will not increase the cost of campaigns.
I believe that to be true, and the point that I'm making is that in order to run advertising, you have to be able to raise money. This bill is not going to increase the pool of money that's available for candidates or for parties to spend. It'll have no effect on that. And so claiming that this is going to double the amount of advertising is just counterintuitive.
I just wanted that for the record, because I hope that if this bill passes and becomes law, this committee can have a review of it and compare before and after.
I think that would be very interesting.
It will be. Representative M.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Melendez. The statements that I find a little unusual the fact that you would disagree with Senator Marty's statement that people are tired of campaigns.
I don't disagree with it.
Okay. Maybe I misunderstood you then, Mr. Melendez, because I think that you probably heard the same feedback that many of us have already about the 08 elections, that people are just sick and tired of the constant pinning away on these elections. Question for you, sir. When it comes to the money and how people campaign, I don't know this stuff, but do you remember when the subsidy program was enacted?
Mr. Melendez.
That's before my time. To your first point, by the way.
Mr. Melendez, let's go through the chair, and that would be a good idea.
Chairman.
Thank you. So if you just want to go through the chair and then the representative you're addressing, that would be helpful for the record. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, to Representative Emmer's first point, I don't disagree with Senator Marty that people are, in fact, tired of campaigning, of campaigning and advertising. What I am saying is that this bill is not going to have any effect on that. The reason people get tired of campaigning and advertising have to do with sort of the nature of politics, the nature of campaigning. This bill is not going to have any effect on that. It's just not going to make them any more tired, which seems to be the claim that Senator Marty is making.
All right. Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Melendez, I have to disagree with you on a couple of levels. Why don't we just start with intuitively? You're going to increase this by 3 months, and you're going to increase it into the summer where people are trying to ratchet it down and enjoy time with their families, and now they're going to be pounded away earlier than they ever were before. The question I had, though, was on the subsidies, Mr. Chair. And I take it, Mr. Melendez, you don't know when those came into effect. Neither do I. It's not a trick question. But you made the statement about there won't be any more money. And I just wanted to ask if you have any opinion or any understanding of when the state subsidies came into being, came into existence, do you think the folks that put the program in place that allows something around $30,000, allows a House candidate to raise somewhere between $28,000 and $32,000 now, depending on whether they're first time or second time candidate, do you think they ever envisioned the folks that wrote that subsidy that were trying to get people to participate in the process, that the combined spending for a House seat in the state of Minnesota would approach $300,000 for a two-year seat that pays a representative somewhere around $30,000, and depending on our argument with per diem. Do you think folks were here, just like you are, saying this will cap the spending and this will make sure that we won't have spending? And now we know that in the last election, we've got several House races where upwards of $300,000 in combined expenditures were made on those races. And with that in mind, don't you think that we run the same risk here, that now we're going to extend the campaign season? That will just necessarily require more competition and more money.
Mr. Melendez.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a point of view about what was on the mind of the legislators who enacted the subsidies. I think the point is very well taken that the chairman made, that we ought to have a review of this after we've gone through a cycle of it, see whether it works, see whether it did make a difference. But as it was before Representative Emmer's time, it was before my time when these subsidies were enacted. To the point about the season being 3 months longer, Mr. Chairman, I make my living as a lawyer, and I'm reminded of a case where there are certain briefs where a lawyer has about 30 days to respond to the other side. And I heard a story one time where a judge asked one of the lawyers, do you really need 30 days to respond to one of these briefs? Can't you get it done quicker than that? And the lawyer said, well, Your Honor, as far as the 30-day period, I'll grant you that the first 27 or 28 days don't matter that much, but the 29th and 30th days are critical. And I think we're going to see the same thing with advertising. The advertising is not going to be front-loaded in the summer. Candidates understand that voters are not paying attention at the beginning of the summer. I think that the cycle of advertising is going to be roughly the same as it has been, but there will be a lot more opportunities for public appearances and direct public contact by the candidates during the summer months.
Representative Emmer, do you have any more questions?
No, I would just say to Mr. Melendez, touche, that's a great story.
Representative Wolfschlager.
All right, Chair, members. I signed on to Representative Simon's bill because I had a contested primary last year, and I try very hard to have a grassroots democracy type campaign. And frankly, the time when people do have extra moments to volunteer is during the summer. And that's been my experience. And if we can get through the primary in June and then get on to the general election and actually have volunteers out there working throughout the summer, that's also, I mean, to be practical about it, that's when you have the most sunlight. And those are the days that when I work full-time. I've got the evenings to campaign, and I would prefer to spend that time on the general election versus the primary. So,
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note, for your sake, that we do have another testifier who I'd like to pivot to. But before I do, if I could shortstop that last question, if you don't mind, and just add a couple of things. First of all, Representative Emmer is correct that we do have figures up into the 200,000 and 300,000 per House race. But that, of course, includes all the independent expenditures. In terms of what the candidates themselves raise and spend, it's much, much lower than that, probably by a factor of 8, 9, or 10. Now, I have friends in Virginia, for example, who tell me that what the candidates spend, never mind independent expenditures, that the candidates in the House of Delegates in Virginia spend upwards of $120,000, the candidates themselves. That's because in that state they have no limits. It's full disclosure, but no limits. So anyone could write a $1 million check to a state House candidate or House of Delegates candidate there. It's just full disclosure. So we have it pretty good. I mean, I know it puts a lot of pressure on us as candidates to raise all this money, but comparatively speaking to states on the East and West Coast, we're doing pretty well. Secondly, I just want to make clear that this business of earlier or later, are we lengthening or shortening the campaign season? Keep in mind there aren't always contested primaries. And look at this last U.S. Senate race, for example. You had an open seat, and on both sides, more so the Republican side, but pretty close on the Democratic side, we all kind of knew who the nominees were going to be very early. Yes, there was a fight within the DFL side, but that was all over but the shooting by the late spring or so. So that's an example where we already have in place what this bill would do. In other words, the fights are settled by April, May, or June, and we have the business of the general election campaign going through the summer. And that's what happened in the U.S. Senate race. And I don't think anyone could say that we spent more or people were more sick than they otherwise would have been of campaigning because we had party business settled earlier. That's what happened in the U.S. Senate race. But, of course, you know, there are circumstances, Representative Wolfschlager and others have experienced it, and we have in statewide races here as well, where the party business isn't settled until much later, and there is a knockdown, drag-out fight until September, and then the candidates, of course, have 8 weeks to introduce or reintroduce themselves to the rest of the state. In the interest of time, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce another important testifier, if I could, Annette Meade.
Representative Simon, if you would, because there may be further discussion, and there could even be an amendment or a suggestion.
Okay.
One or the other. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Annette Meeks, and I'm a co-chair of the Council for Electoral Leadership and a former vice chair of the State Republican Party. The Council for Electoral Leadership, for those of you who are unfamiliar with this, is made up of 74 civic, business, labor, and political leaders representing the Democrats, Republicans, and Independents Party, as well as a few independent voters from throughout the state. Our committee is comprised of former chairs of the major parties, former candidates, former elected officials, and most importantly, many very active participants in our elective process. What brought us all together earlier this year was a belief that the electoral process in Minnesota needs a tune-up. In seeking consensus, we all agreed on early on that moving the primary from September to June is one of the most important improvements we seek, and we ask for your support today. We arrived at this important decision at one of the earliest meetings of members of the commission because we agreed this change was so important. In fact, we wanted this proposal to stand alone in the legislative process to demonstrate our commitment to garnering greater participation and enthusiasm in the process of choosing our candidates. Our reasons for this are many, but I'll touch on three just very quickly. Number one, we believe that the important reason for June primary is a very practical one. And Chair Melendez just touched briefly on it, and Representative Simon did as well. In the current system, the time between the primary election in September and the general election is often too short for election officials to properly manage the process of absentee voting. And this is especially important when we consider our own forces serving overseas. We just learned yesterday that additional members of the Minnesota National Guard will be deployed to Europe this year. Since September 11, 2001, over 11,000 Minnesota National Guard troops have served with distinction in 33 different countries around the globe. These National Guard troops come from small town cities and suburbs, over 66, in fact, from throughout our great state. And most importantly, no matter where the armed services of this country are deployed, whether you be sailor, airman, or marine, or soldier, they deserve to have their absentee ballots counted on election day. Ask anyone, and I'm sure many of you have done this, served as an election recount observer, and you look at the pile of spoiled ballots. These spoiled ballots are kept separated from the ballots for the simple reason: they weren't counted. If you ask the county election person, as I did on several occasions, where these ballots come from, you get the same reply, I'm sure, that I got in Wright County. Most of the ballots were spoiled on election day by voters who incorrectly filled out their ballot. There's also a pile, however, of absentee ballots that weren't counted on election day because they arrived too late. Often these ballots arrive from locations all over the world, forcing our armed forces, men and women, who are defending our country in the global war on terror, into the category of disenfranchised voters. That's wrong, and allowing more than 7 weeks between the primary and general election would eliminate this disenfranchisement almost entirely for our Minnesota Armed Forces. A second important fact you should know is the short time between the primary and general election lends itself to quick, hard-hitting, and let's be honest, negative personal attacks. Why? Because every political person will tell you they work, and number two, you have a short period of time between the primary and the general election to make a decision. The choice is yours. You can take that 7 weeks and run a broad general campaign about the issues of importance to you and the voters in your district, or you can just go out and define your opponent as quickly, meanly, and nasty as possible and define them to the voters before they have a chance to define you and get it over with. Let's be honest, in this day of multi-million-dollar statewide campaigns, you say full speed ahead, damn the torpedoes, and you define your opponent with hard-hitting ads, the stuff everyone hates. The truth of the matter is, you don't have time for anything else in 7 weeks. You don't have time to lay out broad themes of what you would do, what you would like to do, and what your dreams and goals are. A June primary would allow each of our political parties to endorse their candidates and then approximately 4 weeks later allow voters from those respective political parties to cast ballots for their preferred candidates. We wouldn't have inter-party fights narrowly focused all summer long. Candidates would be assured of their place in their respective party county fair booths, and most importantly, their place in our each respective political party's great Minnesota get-together booth at the state fair. Opponents of this idea argue we would have 3 more months of negative political ads burning the airwaves. I strongly disagree, and so do most candidates and political consultants I've ever worked with. Shorter, and Minnesota has, make no mistake about this, one of the shortest general election seasons in the country, give you more intense elections simply because you have less time. Shorter means meaner. Some would say, and I quote, "In other democracies around the world where campaigns are shorter, voters are more engaged and voter turnout is significantly higher than in the U.S. Close quote. Facts tell a very different story, however. According to the International Institute for Democracy, voter turnout is down 10% worldwide and has increased, interestingly enough, in the last decade, only in Eastern European countries that have been reintroduced to democracy. Of course, some 30 countries also around the world have mandatory or compulsory voting, but I don't think we want to go down that route either. And I can tell you, a shorter election season doesn't help us one bit in having cleaner, more issue-driven elections. But finally, and most of you can attest to, candidates want to go directly to the voters and talk to them about their ideas, their hopes, and their aspirations. A longer general election this season would afford candidates that time and ability to get their message out and talk to those voters in many different ways. Right now, we have a narrowly focused campaign targeted towards partisan, likely voters in a primary. And let me tell you, those numbers aren't too happy to talk about either. Since 1970, Minnesota primary voter participation, which was the high mark in the last 30 years, was 32%. The numbers in recent years are even more alarming than our primary voters: 20% in 1998, 17% in 2000, and 14% in 2002. Minnesota needs strong and vibrant political candidates if we're going to continue to lead the nation with our voter turnout in general elections. We can excite more people, involve more people, but most importantly, disenfranchise the fewest number of people by making a simple switch to a June primary. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Simon, for your leadership on this issue.
Thank you. I believe Representative Broad has the amendment.
I do, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Simon, I am 100% in support of what you're doing. I have co-authored and signed on to the bill. I strongly believe that we need to move our primary, I was going to say forward, but I mean backward, and I think June is a great date to settle on. But I'm a little concerned about the effective date and moving it in 2010. We have a large number of National Guards members, and I think Ms. Meeks recognized that in her testimony. But I just, you know, I strongly think that we shouldn't wait for 2010 to help them out. And so I'm hoping that this is a friendly amendment, because it's meant in that regard, that we move to August in 2008. And then move to June in 2010. That will help solve the problem of the many folks that we have serving overseas currently, but then we'll move it to the date that I think has strong agreement as the settling date for the primaries in June.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support half of the amendment, not the other half. And I should say that in the author's amendment, and it was my oversight, there should have been a change to make it 2010 and thereafter for the June primary, and that was part of a, frankly, political accommodation. We don't want anyone to believe that this is about next year's election or defeating or electing any particular candidate for statewide office, and it's not. But just to allay any fears, there was an agreement that we would make this effective in 2010. And so that should have been on the author's amendment. I think it was in the Senate. And so that part I would agree with. I respectfully disagree with the August portion, although I do concede that that would be easier for our servicemen and women. The reason has to do, and I think we're going to hear some testimony coming up here from a representative of the counties, is I'm told that the counties would like, and they can speak for themselves through their representatives, but they would like as much time as possible to gear up for and possibly in some cases staff up for this change, because they're the ones having to do the vote counting. And so apart from the political accommodation reasons for changing it to 2010 effective date, it was also the reason of not wanting to put an undue burden on those who actually do the hard work of conducting the election. So I would respectfully disagree with the August portion, but agree that the whole bill should take effect in 2010.
Representative Simon, it was not in your amendment, but Mr. Gehring's going to draft an accommodation for you, and then when we're finished with Representative Broad's amendment, should her amendment not prevail, then we can go to a proposed amendment by you. So further discussion on the A1 amendment, or on Representative Broad's amendment.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, if we adopt my amendment, we solve that problem. Because then we have the 2010 in here, so that we can kind of do two things at one time here. But in regards to the counties, in regards to the county folks, I'm not sure what gearing up that they're going to need to do. I mean, the August primary is really only a 1 month switch. And so, I mean, they have to do it now in September. And from the testimony and the discussions I've had is that this would actually enable them to have a greater ability to manage the elections process. And I think actually will help in that regard. So I'm not sure what staffing up and gearing up they need to do moving to August. I don't anticipate that this would create any sense of difficulty, and I think would ease the burden for counties in terms of the upcoming election. So maybe we can talk about it along the way, but again, we can kill two birds with one stone, help out our National Guard, and move it to 2010 all in one package. We're talking about efficiency.
Representative Simon.
Well, Mr. Chair, I prefer to kill one bird at a time, first of all. And then secondly, Mr. Chair, I would say this. My other concern about August, and I don't doubt Representative Broad's motives. In fact, I agree with them wholeheartedly, is that in some places in the state, you know, you could shoot a cannon through the place in August. I mean, it's the time when everyone's gone, and I fear that in terms of turnout, August, even more than July, more than June, more than almost probably any month I could think of, is when people are out at the cab and out elsewhere, out traveling. And I really fear in terms of turnout kind of an effect. I know that's not the intention of Representative Broad. I think that's just the unhappy coincidence here. So that's another reason why I think I would urge a no vote on the amendment and then, I guess, vote on what I anticipate to be the next amendment coming up.
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon, I can appreciate that, but we can just look to one of our neighbors in the Midwest in Michigan. And Michigan has a very recreational economy like we do. And Michigan has the primary in that regard in this time frame, and they don't have a problem with primary turnout from my understanding. So, you know, I think it's a fair concern, but I think Minnesotans want to vote. I think Minnesotans are responsible, and they will find a way to make sure that they participate and have the ability to participate in the process if they so choose. So I really do think it's important to make sure that, you know, we have a lot of people serving right now. Right now, they're serving overseas, and, you know, it just seems like waiting until 2010 just isn't the right thing to do. Although, again, you and I are 100% in agreement on the direction that we should go. I'm just trying to actually help on this one.
Representative Pat.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one of the things this does is for anyone who has large proportions of students in their district totally disenfranchises the students. They would just literally have no address in August.
And remember, we are discussing the Broad Amendment here. So that's
the, but the August.
Yes,
the August part.
Just to be clear.
Yeah.
All right. Representative Emmer?
I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad has done a fine job. I support the amendment, and I'd ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Hilton.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to preface my remarks by making it clear that I have no intention of running for any other office. Representative Simon, one of the things that has come up in discussions that I've had about this from a number of different sources is the potential conflict that we have in a June primary with the legislative schedule. It is typical, whether people think it's a good idea or not, to find members of the legislature becoming candidates for another office, and of course most of them end up being candidates for re-election. And what we're talking about with the June primary is having to have the party endorsing conventions in the time frame that the legislature would be in session. Potential of candidates campaigning seeking support at the time that the legislature is in session. And it seems to me to be a somewhat significant conflict. I'm sure you've thought about that and would be interested in your response.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's true. I can't deny that. And I would say, I would even go a step further and say that any legislator, anyone around here, House or Senate, who gets up in the morning, looks in the mirror, and sees a governor or a U.S. senator or some other office, this could be troubling for them. No question about it. If there's a contested primary, as there often is in those situations, it's going to be tough. No question about it. So this bill, I would say, doesn't necessarily make life easier for ambitious state legislators. That's true. I can't deny that. I mean, if anybody sitting around the table is running for governor someday and there's a contested primary, your opponent is going to be able to fly all around the state while you're in session. I can't deny that. That's absolutely true. But I guess that's one of the risks that one has to weigh when one runs for higher office while they're already holding an office. So I can't deny that. Representative Pilkey, you're absolutely right. It does create difficulties for sitting legislators who seek other offices. It's true.
Any further discussion? Then a roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll. Chair votes no.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Broad?
Yes.
Representative Emmer?
Yes.
Representative Pilkey?
Pass.
Representative Powell?
Pass.
Representative Kahn?
No.
Representative Keenan?
No.
Representative Morgan?
No.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Bolson? Representative Peterson? Representative Coffey?
No.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Winkler?
No.
Representative
seeing that there were 10 nays and only 2 ayes with a two abstaining and 2 absent, the amendment does not prevail. And then, Mr. Gearing, do you have Representative Simon's amendment ready for us?
I do, Mr. Chair, although I need to clarify, Representative Simon, one thing. Is the intent to just move the state primary to 2010, or do you want the precinct caucuses also to be the change in date?
No, just the state primary and really all the enabling language,
okay.
2010. In other words, Mr. Gearing and Mr. Chair, I would say that none of this takes place until 2010.
Okay.
So, Mr. Gearing, are you ready, or do you
need
more time? All right. So, Mr. Gearing, why don't you read for us where that change would occur?
Okay. So, this is the change in the bill as amended. Maybe on page 5, line 8, was the effective date. Page 5, line 8, delete 2008 and insert 2010.
Representative Simon, is that your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Simon moves that amendment. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. So the bill is in its form. And then, Representative Simon, I believe we have a couple of more people who wish to testify. So is it Becca Price? She wishes to come down. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Becca Price, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers, which includes the auditors and treasurers and the people who administer the elections law. You've already had a great discussion on the date, the month to have the primary, and that's the same kind of discussion these folks have been having. And to be clear, we have no agreement on it either. election administrators are very supportive of having an earlier primary in order to give us more time between the primary and general elections for overseas ballots, military ballots, more time to program equipment and ballots. One thing to point out, though, is that a lot of the auditor treasurer offices do also administer the property tax system, and we'll be doing property tax collections in May. The counties that have designated election officials have an easier time handling this, but some of the smaller counties that may not have that think that June might be a little bit problematic for them. That said, though, auditors and treasurers have a history of making things work at the local level, and we appreciate the working relationship we are developing with the Secretary of State, and appreciate Representative Simon actually asking us for our input on it early on. We're willing to work with the authors on this bill, and at the end of the day, we'll implement whatever legislature passes. So.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? All right. Representative Brown.
Thank you. And Ms. Price, are you... If you're supporting moving the primary up, is there a concern that those overseas ballots are not being counted? Is that the concern of the election administrators?
Yes.
Ms. Price.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Yes, Chair and Representative Broad, that the ballots aren't coming back.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Broad.
Thank you. And Ms. Price, can you tell me then, does this bill, as it's written today, solve the problem for the people who are overseas right now serving our country as the National Guard members for 2008?
Ms. Price.
Representative Broad, I actually don't know the answer to that question. Joe Mansky from Ramsey County is nodding, saying no.
All right. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, Representative Broad and members, next week we'll be hearing, I think it's House File 1258, I believe is the number, that's my bill, that will... the Secretary of State and our leadership in the military have developed to address that problem for this year. And it's actually, there's some innovative solutions that I look forward to bringing before this committee next week.
Representative, we had the bill scheduled actually this week to be commensurate with this one, but Representative Kalin had a conflict, so we moved it because of testifiers. So we would have had both policy items before us this week, so he's correct in that.
And, Mr. Chairman, for your flexibility, I'm immensely grateful.
That will be noted, too. All right, I think we have one more testifier that wishes to come up, the Township Association, I believe. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kent Sillum with the Minnesota Association of Townships, and I'm not here to testify in favor or against the bill, but to just raise an administrative concern similar to Ms. Price. At the township level, our clerks are elected, the vast majority of the clerks are elected in March of the even number years, which means that they actually start assuming their duties sometime in the early part of April after contest periods and the certificates of election and such, which means that you will have a number of brand new, totally untrained clerks now trying to run an election in June. Currently, while we certainly understand the need to try to move it up a little bit to provide additional timing for some of the administration, with the current training schedule that goes on with our association and Secretary of State staff, most of that training for election officials occurs in July, and it fits well then with the September primary. It would work okay for an August primary because there would be a little time to move it up. And so all I'm raising is that shifting it as early as June will put a little bit more burden on the county auditors and the Secretary of State to try to gear up training events for some very fresh clerks that are expected to administer the election. So just wanted to raise that administrative concern.
Any questions? Seeing no questions, thank you. Anyone else wish to testify for or against the bill? Seeing no other testimony, any further discussion? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I just have a question, Representative Simon, about it's been addressed a little bit with the townships and counties, but really how will it work for municipalities, and because they'll also need to move their time frame up, and so I guess wanted to understand the process and the flow a little bit better.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. Good question, Representative Poppy. This does not affect odd number of year elections. So local units of government are still free to presumably maintain what they have right now, which is usually a later primary for those municipal contests.
Representative Anderson, did you have a question? Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, it isn't really a question, but some points that I thought of here as testimony was provided by the different interest groups. When I think about this issue, I don't think of in terms of our congressional races or U.S. Senate races or even our gubernatorial statewide type races. I think of us on the level of the House and Senate races here in the Minnesota legislature. I also think of it in terms of not the months of June, July, and August, but the months prior to that and how it changes the focus from the summer months when it comes to campaigning and puts it smack dab right into our legislative process. So instead of starting the campaign typically in June when we go out door knocking and start that process, we are going to be moving it into when we are in session. In fact, we will be in session. If you're first elected for Jeremy Kalin here, Representative Kalin, you will only be in the office for a year and 1.5 months before you start your reelection campaign all over again. And that's assuming if you don't have a challenge in your precinct caucus situation. You might be campaigning in December of the same year that you took office. On top of that, when you're looking at the months leading up to the June primary situation, you're asking folks to start raising money. They're $1,500, I think that's what the amount is now, for the affidavit of contributions during session. So while our members are in session, they're going to be raising that money to make sure that they qualify for the public subsidy amount. On top of that, you're going to be even politicizing the legislative process even more than it already is, if you can imagine that happening, because you're not going to have any separation whatsoever from the time that the campaign starts and when the legislative process is going on. There's a reason why we have it in September and why our legislative session ends in May. It's to give us a break. It's to say, we're talking policy now, campaign and the politics come later. So, and then you also have the issue, okay, you've got members in office and you've got the power of incumbency. You're going to be basically campaigning and using your legislative office to campaign. Think about it, because the campaign is not going to be starting, in September or even in June, July, and August. It's starting back in February when you're serving in office and you're doing your press releases just trying to tell your constituents about what's going on. What kind of position are we putting our challenger candidates in? Because they don't have that power of incumbency to use. The whole issue of meeting voters, okay, you've got your town meetings and things like that, but you're not going to be able to go door-to-door because hopefully you'll be focusing on your policy work. I understand what your intent is here, and I feel that's a noble intent, but I think there are serious consequences to moving this date. I also am concerned about how we're going to be confusing voters. I mean, it's hard enough as it is, as we all know, to get voters out and engaged in the legislative process. And now we're going to ask them to start participating in June when they're thinking about their kids' graduations, they're thinking about their summer plans, rather in September when they buckle down and they have their school events, and they know in September that's primary time. We hope that they know that that's the point. And then I also want to bring up an issue that Representative Kahn had mentioned that I hadn't even thought of. We're looking at our college students, you know. What kind of position are we putting them in as far as participating in the process? You know, some of them are already done by June, and then what happens? You know, are they going to be voting at home? Are they going to be voting in the district that they live most of the time at? Or how are we going to handle that? And then, quite honestly, for legislators running for a higher office, I guess I hadn't thought of that, and I get frustrated by that anyways. I think you should be here to focus on your work as a legislator. But these are just some of the issues that I thought of today, and like I said, I understand what you're trying to do, but there are serious consequences to making this move, and I think that we shouldn't take this decision lightly. We need to seriously look at it and how it will impact everyone in the state of Minnesota and our election process overall.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't do it, and thank you for your comments. I appreciate it, and I respect your view on that. Those are intellectually honest arguments. But rather than go down point by point, let me just address a couple things, Mr. Chair. I just have to say, as has been said earlier, I really do just dispute the notion that this is making the election season longer. I don't think it is. I don't think we're starting any earlier. This would move the precinct caucuses back 2 weeks. They're already the first week in Tuesday. Now it'll be the third week in, it's the first Tuesday in March. It'll be the third Tuesday in February. And already, for those of us who have endorsement challenges, and there were a couple last year, one on your side of the aisle that I know of, where there was a spirited endorsement challenge from an incumbent who barely got re-endorsed, but did get re-endorsed, that's already starting while we're in session. And presumably, if you have a primary opponent, you will likely have an endorsement opponent as well. So we just have a difference of opinion. And I can understand scenarios where it might start earlier, but I don't think it's dictated by the primary date. If someone within our own parties really wants to bump us off, if they're smart, they're going to start the summer and the fall before the election year anyway under the current system. So I agree that that's a problem, having us distracted here by politics, but I don't think the date of the primary will necessarily cause that. Secondly, in terms of voter confusion, while I think that's always a concern, and I'm glad that you brought it up in a generic sense, I think right now we all acknowledge the truth, or at least it's the urban myth, that voters really start paying attention after Labor Day. That's what we're all accustomed to hearing. Now they have to pay attention to two things after Labor Day: a primary that's right in their face a week and a half after Labor Day, or a week, and a general election. Here, they can just concentrate after Labor Day, after the kids are back in school, after life is back in order, on one election. And the intra-party squabbles will be solved many months before. So while I respect your opinions and are obviously strongly held, I guess we just don't see it the same way.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson is a real fan of Thomas Jefferson, especially his core principle that change and turnover is really good for legislative bodies and for government. I've always felt like the advantage of incumbency ends up being carried maybe a little too far, and I'm happy to hear that you and I share that same frustration, that same concern, and I hope that we can work together on some legislation that might that might level the playing field a little bit more to encourage, to avoid, I think, what is the natural tendency, unfortunately, of folks to campaign from their seat, their legislative seat, and rather than really making it possible for more and more people to reach voters who don't have the advantage of the public support of an office. So I look forward to working with you on that specific issue, and I share your frustration on it.
Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Simon then will renew his motion that House File 1117, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Registry. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill passes. Thank you. We'll return to the agenda, House File 911, Representative Thiessen. The number would indicate this is somewhat of an emergency, so we apologize for the delay.
That's all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could just take 30 seconds, Mr. Chair, before we start. I was here on House File 1 about a week and a half ago, and I made some comments about Phyla Brace and the CCHC, and they were incorrect and ill-tempered, and I shouldn't have made the comments. And she does represent a broader constituency than I led the committee to believe, and I do just wanted to apologize to her and to the committee members for that.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen, I'll move House File 911, be recommended to pass, and it is going to the Finance Committee. So we referred to the Finance Committee. So with that, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, I think, is actually an exciting opportunity in the healthcare world for allowing some Minnesotans to access their healthcare options in a more effective way. I think we're here today primarily on Subdivision 6 of Section 2, which is on page 3, line 317 and thereafter. One of the things, this bill is coming out of some legislation that passed at the federal level that allows more flexibility for these self-directed support options. And this is this direction of kind of consumer-directed, where the consumer has more control over being able to choose the providers that provide them with services, is a direction that healthcare is moving in general. And this is one area where it's really in the disability area for this bill, where we think that we're going to try to take advantage of this federal law. But what this task force does is will help to implement kind of those self-directed support options, but also look more generally at consumer-directed services and how we best implement and move in that direction going forward. So we'll bring the stakeholders together to kind of move forward as this new model, and it really is a new model that's been evolving over several years, but kind of, I think, accelerating, will look in the future. So that is really what the task force is for.
All right. I think this Henry's here to comment on that, too, and has worked on this. So welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. We're part of the Legal Aid Society in Minneapolis, and we represent people with significant lifelong disabilities across Minnesota. Representative Thiessen is correct in saying that this is a direction that the disability community has been working on for some time. And our state now has a couple of other consumer-directed options in addition to the one proposed here. We do think the advisory task force is extremely important to assure that all those who are going to be implementing this and using it can be at the table during the development of it. We've had some bumps in the road with the current consumer-directed services over the last 4 years because of the budget cuts, and we think this will simply set a forum so people interested can participate. Just to clarify, there's no reimbursement for expenses expected, but we do expect the work of this group to go on for a number of years because it is a direction that I think our state is going in the face of an aging population and continued tight budgets. People can simply make better use of the funds they have access to if we change the rules and make things more flexible. Thank you.
Ms. Henry, while you're here, I'm going to move the A3 amendment
And you have worked on this amendment for the past almost 2 months, with me, actually. And we have talked to the author of the bill. He is very gracious in going to accept this should it pass. So would you explain the A3 amendment and what the A3 amendment does?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The A3 amendment is designed to allow a program in Winona County, Home and Community-Based Options, to continue operation. There have been some issues about the type of license this program should have. They provide respite services and non-residential supports to children with disabilities. The program is very popular in Winona County, and so it has the support of the county. What I think was discovered in the process of the Department of Human Services looking carefully at the program is we don't really have a license for the age group of youth with disabilities. If you think for a minute about teenagers, most teenagers are pretty self-directed, but there are teenagers with disabilities who need support services in order to participate in the community and so on. So this program offers that, but there isn't really a good license for it. This amendment would allow the program to continue operating with license provisions to assure that people are protected and so on, and then require the commissioner to come back next February with a proposal on establishing a license for this age group.
Members, I'm offering the amendment for a number of reasons. There's been a great deal of work on this. The Health and Human Services has agreed to it. We know of no opposition to it. And it continues a program for teenagers with disabilities that is a rather critical program. So is there any discussion to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion fails. Amendment is adopted. Any further discussion to House File 911? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 911, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Thank you, Ms. Henry. And I think President Hilty is back up again with his legislative agenda. Representative Hilty, you can make the motions on your bill, but we do have a significant amendment I think that needs to be explained too. And if Ms. Frazier wants to explain that amendment, that would be acceptable. Why don't we get the bill before us and explain the bill without the amendment and then to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think actually we should just move to the amendment because it is a delete all and it has all of the elements of the original bill. But
then why don't you additional ones. Why don't you move the bill?
I will, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 1110 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be referred to State Government Finance Division.
And then to the...
And I would also...
DE1 amendment, is that correct?
Then move the DE1 amendment, Mr.
Right, so
Chair.
Excuse me, okay. Representative Hilty moves the DE1 amendment. Why don't we put the DE1 amendment in because it is the bill. So all those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. So the bill should be in the order that you wish, Representative Hilty, and if you or Ms. Frazier wish to explain the amendment, which is now the bill.
Perhaps we should ask Ms. Frazier to just explain the origin of the amendment, but then I think, Mr. Chair, since there are 46 sections, we should probably just try to move through the bill one section at a time fairly rapidly, I hope, because I don't think there are very many sections of this bill that are in any way controversial.
Ms. Fraser, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Fraser. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Secretary of State's Office. And the provisions in this bill come from three places. The first is those that were originally in the bill as introduced. The second come from a bill that Representative Morgan is carrying that is our housekeeping bill. And as we reviewed the provisions in that bill, there were a couple provisions that seemed more substantial that should be not in a housekeeping bill, and many provisions that that we believe are not very controversial, but that need more explanation so that people can see that they're not controversial. So instead of putting them in a housekeeping bill, we have moved them to this bill. And then the third is a provision that Representative Howes asked us to add to the bill from a bill that he is carrying. So all of the provisions in the bill, I believe, have been introduced as legislation that has been referred to this committee, and we're just kind of rearranging exactly where it sits. And as I said, most of the provisions that have been added to this bill, we believe, are fairly uncontroversial. And we will obviously be answering questions as we move through. But we have been working closely with the cities and the counties and the voting rights groups and the disability community on putting this bill together, on putting all of our legislation together. So all of them have been weighing in.
All right. So, Ms. Fraser, you want to walk us through anything that is either non-controversial or controversial?
Well, Mr. Chair, I can. I think I can describe the sections, and we'll let Ms. Fraser answer any tough questions about them.
That's probably a good idea.
Mr. Chair, members, Section 1 basically clarifies the issue of when it's possible to circulate petitions in order to get on the ballot by petition rather than just paying the filing fee. It's clarifying more or less the situation that arose with Representative Gutnick when there was a challenge. Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, there are actually five provisions throughout the bill that deal with when petitions can be circulated because the statute is not clear. So sections 1 and 2 actually deal with petitioning to become a major or minor political party. And then sections 19, 46, and 18 also deal with this issue related to, as Representative Hilty said, candidates filing petitions in lieu of filing fees, petitions for amendments to a city charter, and petitions for minor party or independent presidential electors. Section 3 deals with a separate issue. It clarifies that county auditors should mail a violation notice to voters if the voter voted in an address or they do not maintain residence. So, for example, if after an election, a county auditor sent out a mailing that was returned, and it said clearly that the forwarding order had been in place since before the election, they would then know that the person had not voted in the correct precinct. But currently, it's not in place that they should actually notify the person that that was a violation and that they should vote at the correct precinct in the future. So that's what that section does. Section 4 clarifies that the statutory definition of signature applies to signing voter registration cards. Sections 5 and 8 together allow for online voter registration for those who have Minnesota driver's licenses or state ID cards. The current statutory regulations of a voter registration card says it has to be mailable and it has to include a signature, which would not be in place if we were if we had online voter registration. So this makes some changes to allow for that. We're limiting online voter registration to those who have Minnesota driver's licenses or state ID cards. Because those people are already in the state system, we currently, for every voter registration, check with the Department of Public Safety, make sure that there's a match between the driver's license numbers. So these people would be in their system, and the Department of Public Safety already has their signature, which we could access if we needed to. Section 5 also gives organizations or individuals collecting voter registration cards 10 business days to turn them in instead of 10 calendar days. Calendar days means right now if it falls on a Sunday, you actually only have 8 days, and when you have volunteers collecting the cards and then turning them into a central location, we just want to be sure there's enough time to actually get that done. Section 6 prohibits groups doing voter registration drives from paying employees on a per-card basis or using a strict quota. What we found is using this method of compensation encourages bad behavior. That if somebody is being paid on a per-card basis, there's an incentive to duplicate cards or to make up cards, which we do not want to be incentivizing. So this provision would prohibit that method of compensation, and this has been done in other states. Section 7 removes the requirement for cross-referencing vouchers and voters in the statewide voter registration system. So currently, if I vouch for Representative Hilty, it would be noted both on his record in the statewide voter registration system and on my record. And what we've heard from the county auditors is that this is incredibly time-consuming when they're entering same-day registrants. Now, the vouching information is attached to the voter registration card, and they're maintained for 22 months. So if there's any problem with that individual's registration, the information is available, it is accessible, and we could still get to it without requiring counties to spend so many hours entering data that usually isn't needed. Section 9 allows voters to check online to see if they're registered to vote. Right now, county auditors get a lot of calls, and this would allow give voters access to that information if they entered their birth date, exact address, and name. Which is information that's already available to voters if they called a county auditor and gave that information. Section 10 is an attempt to make sure that all of the addresses in the statewide voter registration system are as accurate and up-to-date as possible. So it would require us to send a non-forwardable postcard to every registered voter 7 weeks before the general election. Postcards that are returned, we would then know, okay, this person doesn't live there. This would, in addition to making the rosters as clean and accurate as possible, would also make the database, which many candidates, political parties, and political groups purchase, as accurate as possible and potentially more valuable for your use or their use. Section 11 lengthens the period of time that voters who have not voted stay on the registration list. Right now, if you don't vote in 4 years, your record is made inactive and you won't show up on the rosters at the polling place. This lengthens that period of time to 6 years. So that people who vote irregularly aren't thrown off the list and then show up and think they're registered, but they're really not. This also clarifies that those who submit absentee or mail ballots, but for some reason they're rejected, maybe they forgot to sign it, for the purposes of have they voted in the past 4 or 6 years, they would count. Right now, I think there's some confusion about, okay, we got an absentee ballot. If an absentee ballot comes in late, then it counts. But right now, if it's rejected, so you got it in on time, but you didn't sign it, then it doesn't count. So we're just trying to make that consistent. Section 17 and 44 both deal with affidavits of candidacy. And for ever, I think, affidavits of candidacy had to have an original signature, so the candidate had to come in and actually sign the filing. For the first time this year, the Secretary of State's office accepted one affidavit of candidacy by fax, which raised the question of, is that okay? Is that not okay? And the county auditors are basically just looking for clarification, one way or the other. So this starts the conversation with requiring an original signature, but we're not wedded to that position. You know, just the county auditors just want to know, is it okay or not? Section 12 deletes a requirement that was put in place recently, requiring that on the envelopes in which absentee ballots are mailed back, there be a flap to cover up the voter's information. The rationale for this was had to do with military and overseas voters, because they are required to put their military ID number on that envelope. And since Social Security numbers serve as military ID numbers, we didn't want everyone who saw the piece of mail to have access to that person's Social Security number. This requirement was also put in place for domestic absentee ballots. And what we've heard is that it's quite expensive and cumbersome. And so we would like to remove the requirements in statute that domestic absentee ballots have the flap. And our plan is, in through rulemaking, to require the flap for non-registered voters who would be putting down their driver's license number or other information, but not require it for people who are pre-registered. Section 13 specifically states that county auditors have to provide the disabled accessible voting machines during the absentee ballot period. This is, I think, understood, but it's just clearly stating it in this section. Section 14 clarifies an issue that right now election judges may not process absentee ballots until after the last mail delivery of the day, which is confusing for voters because they don't know when absentee ballots are going to be processed. And voters have a right, if they voted by absentee ballot and have changed their mind or something has happened, to go to the polling place and cast a regular ballot as long as their absentee ballot hasn't been counted yet. When the judges process the ballots, they write on the roster AB next to your name. So if you come in and that's there, then it's too late. You've already voted. If it's not there, then when they process the absentee ballots, if you've come in and voted in person, they'll see that and discard your absentee ballot. This would give information to voters about exactly when they would have that window of time when they could come in. Section 15 allows any county to use an absentee ballot board. Currently, it's limited to counties with counting centers. An absentee ballot board is an entity that includes election judges of both parties that prior to the election accept and reject the absentee ballots. And I think this is a really great service to voters because it gives, if an absentee ballot is rejected prior, at least 5 days before the election, perhaps because it wasn't signed, it gives the voter an opportunity to get a replacement ballot and correct it and get their vote counted. Even though the statute currently limits the use of absentee ballot boards to counties that use counting centers, we believe that this is not being strictly followed. So this would kind of bring everybody, make everybody kosher, so to speak. Section 16 would change the scope of the absentee ballot board's functions. As I said, most of them accept and reject absentee ballots. Right now, the statutory authority allows them to also count the ballots, and none of the absentee ballot boards that we're aware of actually use this authority. And we think the ballot should be counted at the polling place with all the other ballots from that precinct. So this is removing that authority that currently isn't used to count the ballots. Section 16 requires the Secretary of State to provide counties with a sample replacement ballot and the envelope. So if an absentee ballot is rejected, we need to have a sample of what the replacement ballot and envelope should look like. Understanding is that in most cases, counties actually use the regular absentee ballot and envelope. They don't want to incur the expense of printing a replacement set for the few voters that they're sending these out to. And so this...
Oh. I think you're off by a section.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. So... Okay. I'm sorry. No, that's what that does. So Section 16 does both of those things that I was just discussing. Section 18 deals with another lawsuit that happened this past fall with a potential candidate, Brian Smith, who was kicked off of the ballot for filing in the wrong place. Currently, if your district is fully contained within a county, then you're required to file at the county seat. If your district crosses county lines, then you're required to file at the Secretary of State's office. Mr. Smith was a candidate for a Minneapolis district, and didn't understand the requirements and came to the Secretary of State's office, turned in his filing, and it was discovered later in the day that he actually was required to file at Hennepin County, and there wasn't time to contact him and to have him file at the appropriate place. And so the court ruled that he was not allowed to be on the ballot. So this is trying to clear that up and allow candidates for state offices to file either at the Secretary of State's office or the county in which they live, whichever they choose. Section 19 is paired with sections 30, 35, and 47. And these sections require candidates for county, city, school district, and hospital district offices who are write-in candidates who want their votes counted to file a written request with a filing officer. This is currently what's done for state-level offices so that the election judges aren't forced to tally how many votes Mickey Mouse got versus Donald Duck. And would be helpful for administration at the local level if we put this in place as well. You'll notice that townships are not on this list, and that's because at the township level there are so many write-in candidates that it actually wouldn't be helpful, and so they are exempt. And the school districts have actually also asked to be exempt, so part of an amendment that I think that was distributed would actually delete the Section 35 dealing with bringing school districts into that fold. The other thing that these sections do is it changes the deadline for filing this request from the Thursday before the election to the Tuesday before, so a week before. Of course, if we're giving directions to election judges, the county auditor needs to put the list together to be sent to the precinct, and having the deadline the Thursday before gives them very, very little time to compile those lists and put them in the appropriate precinct boxes. Often, election materials are picked up on the day Monday or sometimes even Friday, or perhaps even earlier, but this would be helpful. Section 21 allows polling places in the metro area to be a mile outside of the precinct's boundaries. Currently, they're allowed to be 3,000 feet outside the boundaries, so this gives a little bit more leeway if there isn't an appropriate building inside the boundaries of the precinct. Section 22 requires the Secretary of State's office to send information to newly naturalized citizens on registering to vote and serving as election judges. Section 23 replaces the current Help America Vote Act complaint process, which we're required to have by federal law. Currently, all of the complaints are filed with the Secretary of State's office, even if they're complaints about city or school district elections. Since the county auditors do most of the training and interaction with the city and school districts, it seemed to make more sense to bring them into the process so that complaints about that level would be filed with the county, complaints about the county would be filed with the Secretary of State's office, and complaints about the Secretary of State's office would be sent to the Office of Administrative Hearings. So it brings them into that process. That's the primary change that it makes. Section 24 makes some changes to voting by mail, which is currently allowed in small jurisdictions around the state so that they have all mail balloting. This changes the period during which county auditors may send the ballots to voters. Right now, absentee voting begins 30 days before the election, and right now they can't send out the mail ballots until 20 days before the election. So if somebody's going to be out of town during the 20 days before the election, so they won't be at home to receive the mail ballot, they're coming in during that 10-day window to vote absentee. So if we allowed the counties to send out the absentee ballots, or the mail ballots, 30 days ahead, it would eliminate some of the people coming into their office to vote absentee in person. In order to accomplish this, we would also want to be sure that anyone that pre-registered before the deadline, which is 20 days before the election for pre-registration, that there's a subsequent mailing to them so that everyone who's registered by that deadline gets a mail ballot. Section 24 the same section has provisions about having election judges accept and reject absentee or these vote by mail ballots prior to election day. And I was just speaking to the representative from the townships prior to this, and we may want to make some adjustments to this language, but we don't have it currently written. But
okay, Ms. Frazier and Representative Hilty, we're almost out of time, and there is one more amendment that's a minor cleanup amendment that Mr. Gehring wants to do today.
Okay.
I want to lay this bill over, and we'll have it first up tomorrow, because they have taken no public testimony on it, and no one's had time to ask questions. And I know Representative Powers has one small question, but let's do this amendment first. So, okay. All right, so we don't even have this amendment ready for tomorrow, so maybe with Representative Hilty and the Secretary of State's office, we can make sure that this amendment that was passed out to us is in its proper form. And then, Representative Howes, you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, I have a verbal amendment. It's just changing one word. It's very simple.
Do you want to propose that right now, and we'll have Representative Hilty take a quick look at it?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're working off the delete all amendment, correct?
Yes, we are.
You go to page 22. Line 30, change the must to a may. This is the portion of the bill that Representative Hilty and the Secretary of State have allowed me to put in. It's a bill that I'm carrying, but we really don't want to force a county to do that. We just simply want to give them the option. So I think may would be better than must. I'm sorry, I didn't.
I'm going to go to Mr. Gehring here just to make sure that there's no other change that this triggers somewhere else in that section. And so, Mr. Gehring, can you just explain once again the Representative Howes amendment? Then we'll go to Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, my understanding of the amendment is on page 22, line 30, change the must to a may. And I guess I would have to take some time to look through to make sure there's not other effects.
Representative Hilty, what's your position on that?
Mr. Chair, I don't see any problem with that. This is my understanding is that Representative Hollis brought this forward at the request of the counties, and I think that, you know, if they're interested in doing this, they certainly could be allowed to, but I don't see any problem with making it optional rather than a requirement.
Could we, Mr. Gary, could we make that part of your amendment tomorrow so we'd actually see it in writing? Is that okay with you, Representative Hollis?
Yes.
Why don't we do that, and then we have that as part of what will be a bigger cleanup amendment on this. I have one more observation here, and this is in part to the Republican or the minority staff. We don't have rules for this committee, and today illustrates why. We got this amendment in late afternoon yesterday. Within about 15 minutes of us getting it, Mr. Malander took it down and showed it to the Republican staff, and I know that you were frustrated about getting an amendment of this length that late. Well, we share your frustration. And if we had had a 24-hour rule, we wouldn't even have this before us today. So I want to thank you for accommodating us on that. But I'll also say that if we get an amendment, any amendment, we'll try to get it down to you within about 15 minutes of us getting it so you have it. So there's no intent here on our part to do something under the table. But that's one reason why I did not have rules at the beginning, because when we get down to this point, these things happen, and we have to do the best we can. Both of us have to do the best we can. So we were equally frustrated, but we're working with it. So thank you for accommodating us. We're going to lay this bill over. It'll be the first one on the agenda tomorrow, and Mr. Gehring will have that amendment. And then if there's any other fix amendments we can have for tomorrow and then testimony.
It's not coming to you yet.
So with that, members, meeting is adjourned.